There are many angles and facets that you could study. You're probably well aware that Purim is, in one way, the highest day of the year. I'm sure you've come across that idea. Sources say that Yom Kippur is only similar to Purim. That means you could achieve more on Purim but through an ecstatic sort of experience that you can on Yom Kippur through beating the body down. You deal with the body, try to negate the body in two different ways on Purim and Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, what you do is try to transcend the body in such a way that the body has no say. It's kind of a suffering that we put the body through in terms of fasting and so forth. Yom Kippur, about Purim, which is a day when we most certainly not sad or cause ourselves to suffer in any way, we can transcend in a way that seems to be higher than Yom Kippur. So what is the secret of this, and what's the purpose of it? What ideas can we... What theme, what dimension can we pick out here to amplify our understanding? Maybe we could start like this. You know that one of the fascinating questions about Purim is that when the Gemara, the Talmud, wants to study, wants to look at the root of things, so, as we've learned together many times, it looks at the root of the word. If you have a word or a name in Torah, then the root of that word or that name is the root of the idea. If you could trace, as we've said, as the idea we've shared together a number of times, if you could trace a word to its root, I mean, you could really understand what the letters are saying, the numerological, the number, the numerical value of the word, the shape of the letters, the sound, all the aspects of the word itself, you'd have all information about the concept. Because in Torah, the word is the thing. Torah is Hashem's word. Pointed out many times, that's why the word davar in Hebrew, which means a word, really it means an object as well. Because every object in the world is really a word of Hashem. So that unlike other languages where we agree by convention that certain words mean certain things, in Hebrew, the word actually is the thing. So if we trace an idea to it, we look at the word for that thing or the name, and then we try to understand what that name is telling us. It's ironic that in Purim, even the word Purim, which is not a Hebrew word, Purim is a Persian word, meaning lots. To draw lots. But even that word tells you what Purim is, because the whole idea of Purim is that they did it by lottery, meaning luck, meaning a denial of Hashgach, a denial of a divine intervention. Well, of course, the whole purpose of Purim is to us, for us to prove that in the darkness, where we don't see any divine revelation, that actually Hashem is functioning. Wait, do you want to switch up the thing? Is that thing making a noise? Not that? What is making a noise? That's it. Maybe you could switch it off for me. This orange is silent. Secondly, we said that if you can trace a thing in the Torah back to close to the creation, then you're tracing it close to its root. Because if you could trace the thing back to the very beginning of Bereshit, of Genesis, so then by definition you're looking at the conception of that thing. For example, a technique that the mystics use, or the deeper commentaries use, is any time you wish to trace an idea in Torah, you trace it back to where it appears in the 6 days of creation. Because right there, you must be witnessing its birth, its creation. The whole world was created in the 6 days. And so it follows that any detail of the world must have had its nucleus origin then. So if you could trace the thing back to where the Torah talks about it in the first 6 days, then you would be looking at the source of that thing. Now when the Gemara does this exercise in Purim, it takes the names that the Megillah is built around. I'm sure you've already studied the idea this morning. Presume that the word Megillah means the scroll, right? The Megillah of Purim, which is essentially a hidden document. Hashem's name doesn't appear. You studied this idea. Adotli probably mentioned it. And yet the word Megillah also is Megaleh, which means to reveal. The same word in Hebrew, which is a Megillah, means to ha'ir, it's a scroll, in the case of Purim, that has no revelation. And yet Megaleh means to reveal, right? Shows you things. The Gemara, when it wants to reveal the hidden in Purim, asks where we find the names of the main characters, protagonists of the Megillah, where we find them in Chumash. And if we can try and trace them all the way back to the beginning, that would tell us. So the Gemara goes through, it looks at all the names, Mordechai, Esther, as you well know. Esther is not found in Revelation. The word Esther means to hide. The whole idea of the Purim is a hiding, and Esther is Hastir Astir Panai, I will certainly hide my face. And that's where we find the word Esther. Exactly, which is really a reference to the secret of a Jewish woman who maintains herself hidden. There's a lot to say about that too. But let's focus this morning on another name, and that is Haman. So when the Torah says, where do we find the window? When the Gemara says, where do we find the name of Haman in the Torah? The Gemara says, Haman min haTorah minayin. Where do we find the name Haman in the Torah? Let's go searching through Chumash, and let's find where we see the name Haman hinted at or referred to in Chumash. Because wherever we find Haman in the Chumash would be a nucleus of what he later brought to the world. Now, that's the idea. And amazingly, the Gemara finds it, certainly in the 6 days of creation, right back at the creation of the world, and in the original sin. Haman, the force of evil, who tries suicidally to destroy Jews, even though he pays with his own life for it, right, which is what the Haman ideology always is, the Amalek ideology, right? Haman coming from Amalek, always a suicidal attempt. Yes, they'll send their trains to take Jews to the crematorium, even if they need the trains for the war effort. Well, it doesn't make any sense at all. But that's what they're in the world for, is to destroy Jews. So Haman represents that energy. He's located where? In the original tree of sin. In the original tree of the knowledge of good and evil, right, is the location of Haman. Where? When a man eats of the fruit, actually woman, eats, gives him to eat, and they've eaten from the fruit, a man hides in the garden. He's hiding under the trees. And Hashem appears in the garden. One of the things he says to him is, first he says, where are you? Right? Ayeka. The word Ayeka, by the way, is the same as Eicha, another Megillah. See the crossover here. Eicha is the Megillah of Lamentations. The word Eicha means the introduction to the concept of mourning and misery and lamentations. And when Hashem says to man in the garden, where are you? Ayeka, where are you? That's an expression of mourning, because when God has to ask man where he is, it means a normal relationship. So the where are you is an expression of Eicha. But the next question he asks him is even more potent. He says to him, Hamin ha'etz. Did you eat from the tree? He asks man, did you? And the word hamin, which really is untranslatable in English, it's only, yeah, it's only syntax. But it means, it's the question, it's the phrasing of the question, did you? Did you eat? Hamin, did you eat from? Yeah, did you eat from? The question that God asks. The question that Hashem asks man, did you eat from the fruit? That question itself is the name Haman. What does that mean? What does that mean? Hamin in Hebrew, you're well aware that in Chumash there are no vowels. So the word Hamin, which is a composite word meaning did you eat, that is the word Haman. What's that got to do with the fruit and the question that Hashem is asking? Why is it located in the question itself? Why doesn't it even have any meaning? The only question, the only meaning it has is the question. You understand? It's not the word that says eat, or fruit, or tree, or evil. It's the word that says, did you? That's all. The question, did you? That's Haman. I mean, at a superficial glance, it looks very much like a very poor fit. Like you try to find the three words Haman, and you found them there. So, let's say it's there. Had it been the word evil, maybe, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, I would have said the word evil, mate. But the word, did you? What? You have a problem. What? Let's try to understand it. Let's look a little deeper and see what we can fathom here. See, the idea of Purim, the thing we have to trace is that the greatness of Purim, the work of Purim, the greatness of the Jewish people that was brought out at Purim, is the idea that Hashem remains hidden and we have to reveal Him. Let's try and trace it like this. You know, we've said before that there are two kinds of miracle in the world. Right? There's the perceived miracle, what's called nes nigla, an open miracle, and there's what's called a hidden miracle. Right? That which you have to want to see. Yes, if you want to see it, if you want to be cynical and skeptical, you can ignore it. If you want to see it, you see it. We live in the Purim generation. We live after the Megillah of Esther, where we see no more revealed miracles. We see only the hidden ones, which means you've got to want to see them. If you're skeptical and cynical, then you won't see them. The revealed miracles, you'd have to be blind not to see. What's the difference between revealed and hidden miracles, without going into too much detail? The difference is that a revealed miracle is where a law of nature changes itself. A law of nature turns itself upside down. Something falls up instead of down. That would be a revealed miracle. A hidden miracle is where something extremely improbable, something extremely coincidental happens. No law of nature was overturned, but the fact that all those things happen at the same moment exactly, now that is miraculous, although it doesn't change nature. Actually, the mystics explain and the philosophers of science explain that the two miracles are really one and the same. Because a law of nature, have you studied this before? A law of nature is really only a description of a frequency anyway. a law of nature doesn't mean it has to be. It just means an observed frequency anyway. But if we get time, maybe we can talk more about that. However, in our perception, there are two classes of miracles. There are those where you see, let me give you an illustration. Let's say, I'll make it clear. Let's say you're going for a jog in the desert, and you don't realize there's a cliff that you're about to head over. And you run over the edge of the cliff. And as you're about to become part of the scenery, 5,000 feet below, you clutch onto a twig that's growing out of the cliff face, and you're holding on for dear life, and the twig begins to pull itself out of the cliff face. At exactly that moment, just as it comes loose, and you're about, there just happens to be someone on the top of that cliff that day who's practicing throwing ropes over the edges of cliffs at that moment, and he does that just at the point where, and you grab onto it, and he pulls. Now, there's nothing miraculous about that. But you'd be probably pretty religious for the next half hour or so if that happened to you, because the statistical probability of those two things happening at once is so slim that you'd be very impressed. Usually it doesn't last more than about half an hour. But you know, you'd probably put on filling the next morning, you'd go around telling the story for the rest of your life, right? And you'd be convinced that you saw a miracle, even though nothing happened there. Right? A revealed miracle would be if you fell off the edge of the cliff, and as the thing pulled out of the cliff face, you suddenly levitated, floated up, and were deposited. That would last for about 3/4 of an hour, right? You know, and you'd be diagnosed as psychotic, you know, if you told anybody. But the point is that would be a revealed miracle, yes? Because nature changed, as it were. Your perception of nature, that things fall down, fall up. Actually, it wouldn't impress anybody these days. New York Times would send out an investigation team to see where the magnetic forces are and how the, you know, and that's if they believed you. But the point is that the world these days, we don't get miracles because we don't know how to use them. But that is the difference between hidden and revealed. And all we see is the hidden miracles. If you examine your life, you'll see that your life consists of those. Especially in Israel, by the way. Doesn't it often happen to you? You speak about somebody and they appear? That happened to you? It happens often, but it happens here especially. Things happen that come together that Rav Miller from Gateshead tells a story of a young man who was in the yeshiva, whom it happened some years ago. Once he noticed that this young yeshiva bacher was doing certain things more strictly than other people. So he asked him, "Why are you being so strict?" He said, "I've seen miracles. Hashem expects more from me." So he asked him, "What miracle did you see?" So this young man told him the story. He was from Morocco, Tunis or Morocco, and Tunisia, and he came to the yeshiva. Why? Because he was getting married to a French girl or Moroccan girl, and she decided, he was a Baal Teshuva, that without real learning he wasn't going to amount to anything. So she sent him to yeshiva, she sent him to Gateshead, very good move. She sent him to yeshiva for a few days before they got married, at least get a taste of it. And she was a very bright girl. What happened after a few days was he realized he couldn't do without more of this, without more learning, that he'd never amount to anything unless he had learning. So he wanted to come back and learn full-time in yeshiva after they got married, and married in Paris. So he went to Rav Miller and said, "Look, I'd like to come back and learn, and I just finished my doctoral thesis in science at the Sorbonne, so I have a degree, but I don't have any way of earning a living. I sit and learn in yeshiva full-time. How am I going to earn a living? In Newcastle, in Gateshead, in the north of England, what?" And he didn't speak English even. So Rav Miller said to him, "I don't know, but Rav Dessler's in town. Go ask Rav Dessler." Great Rav Dessler. This must have been before Rav Dessler died in 1953. This was in those years. So the young man went to Rav Dessler, and he said to him the problem. So Rav Dessler said, "Look, what you need is upon us, and if I had them to give out, I'd give out, but I don't have. But you look like a serious young man, and I'll just tell you one thing." And that is a verse that says, "Ratzin Yireyav Yaseh." Hashem does the will of those who fear Him. That's all. If you want it, it'll work out. If you fear Hashem, He does your will. So the young man was overjoyed. That's all he needed to hear. He went and told his kala that all they have to do is come back to Gateshead and sit there, and Hashem will take care of them. He didn't have to worry at all. And she was overjoyed too. They had a tremendous level of emunah. And Rav Miller said he didn't know what they were getting so excited about, because he didn't know how this was going to work. But they had tremendous faith that it would work. They went back to Paris. They got married. As they were leaving Paris for the airport, for Gateshead, on the way, he got out of the taxi to go and say goodbye to his professor of science at the Sorbonne, just in courtesy. And he went to speak to this professor and say goodbye to him and thank him for the teaching and so forth. On the way down the stairs to the taxi, the professor said to him, "By the way, I just remembered that I got a letter this morning from King's College in Newcastle asking us to send an exchange student whom they'll pay to do some science research in Newcastle, which is the town right next to Gateshead, just across the bridge. Okay? So maybe you'll go." So he thought to himself, well, sounds a little strange. The first thing they went through, he said, when he heard that, was "Ratzon Yireyav Yaseh." But, you know, science, not going there to do science. He's going there to learn in yeshiva. And he doesn't speak English. How's he going to work? So he took the letter. The professor scribbled him a note of reference. He should be the exchange student. He took the letter, he went to Gateshead, he went to the to King's College in Newcastle, he presented the letter, and the professor who wanted him to do the research said to him, sounds fine. So he said, but look, he couldn't speak any English. The professor said, no, I speak French fluently. Oh, fine. So they started speaking in French. So he said, but I can't work with a team of researchers. The professor said, no, this isn't a teamwork. I need you to do some personal research for me. Oh, I said, fine. But how much do you pay? So the professor told him a figure, which was much more than he needed to survive on with his colour in yeshiva. So he said to the professor, what would be if I do this research half day for you? Yes, and leave me free for half a day. The professor said, well, we could only pay you half the stipend, and it will take a bit longer, but that's fine with me. So he said, fine. And they managed to live on two-thirds of the half that they paid them. Yes, he used to work till 1 o'clock every day doing scientific research. He's learned 8 hours a day in yeshiva after that. And many vacations, 2-3 months at a time. He got the research done quickly. That's what he did. Now, what are the chances? Now, you figure out. What are the chances that at one and the same moment, that day the letter would have arrived? That it, you see, there's no miracle over there. There's exchange students all the time. There's letters going all over the place. There's people traveling. There's science students. There's none. But that it would exactly be that morning at that professor, the one that happened to see you, who needed exactly that, who spoke French. I mean, it's mind-boggling. So he said he'd seen miracles. What he meant was he'd seen a... Rav Destra actually said that was close to revealed. That's a hidden miracle, but that's pretty close to... If you're sensitive and you've looked in your own life, you should have seen... I've seen some things in my own life that are... You want to hear a couple? Who's here South African? Do you know Neville Garber? Do you know Neville Garber? You know? This is what happened to Neville. It's a friend of mine. This is what happened to him. This man, I mean, I collect these stories so I could tell you all day. But this man decided to move home. And he decided to buy a home near Osamach. Didn't get much more involved. The Yiddish guy wanted to move there. And his wife were having, you know, doubts. Is this the right place? So I said, no, you're making a big move. Is it the right place? Isn't it? They decided to go for it, but uncertain. They met on the property, right, which is in a place called Lyndhurst, which is right near Osamach, walking distance in Johannesburg. They met on the property to see whether this piece of ground was what they, because it was, they had to build the home there. The previous home had been razed, had been demolished. The only thing that was standing was the servants' quarters, which is quite symbolic of South Africa these days. I mean, that's another point. But the point is that they met on this property in order to see whether they would, yes, to discuss what they were going to do. So she was on the site, and he walked across the rubble of this demolished building to meet her. And they both told me that when he arrived at the sight of his wife, he was absolutely white-faced. Why? Because although this is not his nature, for some reason, as walking through the rubble, he saw a piece of paper sticking out, cardboard sticking out of the rubble, and for some reason he picked it up. Okay? It was a wedding photograph of his parents, of his own parents, that had been stolen from a property in Kensington 15 years before, and had been, you know, Neville, and had been, you know the story? And had been lying someplace with a rust mark around it where a barrel had been on top of it on this property, okay? And that's what he found on this plot, that they were wondering if it's the right place for them. And today it stands on the mantelpiece of the house they built on that thing, and you can go see it. Now, you know, you tell me, I mean, that a few billion years of molecules bumping into each other by accident, you know, I mean, you need your head read. But nothing miraculous happened. By the way, when he told his Rebbe about it, his Rebbe happens to be one of the great men of this generation. His Rebbe couldn't understand the point of the story, could not understand what he was trying to tell him. He didn't understand, you know, why? Because the reason that some people are impressed by this kind of thing is because it proves that something's going on. But a person is holding on a high enough level, or something, he doesn't need things like this to prove that anything's going on. So he couldn't understand, never let him repeat the story a few times, and he walked away. He couldn't understand what was the point of the story. I was present at a similar event where a friend of mine, and you can check this out with him, you can check me. His name's Shmuel Geller, and he lives in Zichron Yaakov. What happened to him was, you better hold on to your title for this, okay, because this is wild. What he did was this. It's a fascinating story. Shmuel teaches in yeshiva in Zichron Yaakov. Many also know people know him. He had a grandfather who came from Galicia. And this man went to Galveston, Texas. And he, two generations ago in America, and he was a wonderful man. He was a shechet and a moel and a rebbe. He started a cheder and he started a whole Jewish community and a big family. He was an unusual man, learned. And the family in the next two generations spread out all over the states. And Shmuel Geller, my friend, decided to write a book about his family. in order to make them more aware who their grandfather was and so forth. So he wrote a beautiful book with a family tree and photographs of all the branches of the family. And he decided he was going to publish this book himself and take it to America and give it out to all the members of his family. So he published the book. I have a copy someplace. It's beautifully done. It has a picture of his grandfather and a little ship sailing the waves. And it's called From Galicia to Galveston. That's what it's called. Very beautifully done. But on the back of the book, yes, in other words, if you look at the cover, that's what you see. But if you turn it over, it has a Hebrew cover. Why? Because from that side of the book, as if it was a Hebrew book, he published something that his grandfather had written when he was a young boy. He had been handed down in the family, Shmuel had inherited in the family, handed down from his grandfather, a handwritten pamphlet of notes that his grandfather had written when he was 18 years old, all those years back in Galicia and Yeshiva. He had been studying with a young Chavrusa, who was also the same age. The two of them had put together their thoughts on the Gemara, and they'd written them down, and apparently they were very good. So in tribute to his grandfather, for those who were able to read it, Shmuel decided to publish his grandfather's Chiddushei Torah in the same volume. Okay? So this side of the book reads like I described. That side reads Chiddushei Torah, the Torah ideas of Shmuel Geller, his grandfather's name, and underneath it, the name of whoever that young friend was with whom he studied all those years before. The two names appear, and that is how the book was published. As soon as the book was out, Shmuel decided to go to the States to give it out to his family in order to, you know, that's what he did it for. And when he got onto the plane at Tel Aviv, when he got onto the plane at Lod, what happened was, it just happened to be an empty seat next to him. And he just happened to have a copy of his book with him, and it happened to be lying on the seat, and it happened to be lying with the Hebrew side up. And as he's buckling in, a young Israeli has the yeshiva bocher from, you know, one of the yeshivas, yes? Young Israeli is walking past, and he comes back, and he looks, and he says, hey, that's my name. He was the grandson of the friend named after his grandfather, just as Shmuel was named, and that's how they met each other. Of course, we don't get excited about these things. Right, that's what happens. Now, you go figure out the statistics, huh? Of those events crisscrossing in that fashion that he... Now, I was present when he told the story to his Rebbe. It happens to be my Rebbe. I was present, we were at a shiur, and he grabbed back from America that day, and he ran up to him, and he said, and he blurted out the whole story, this unbelievable coincidence. So Shapiro looked at him, and he said to him, no. So he told the story again, so he said to him, no. What are you trying to tell me? And slowly, as the enlightenment dawned, he said to him, Atame vili raya shakodosh bohu manigata. He said, well, are you bringing me a proof that Hashem runs the world? And he walked away in disgust. Right? And you're trying to prove to me that Hashem runs, you needed to see that in order to have faith? Meantime, Shmuel was jumping up and down saying, oh, they're fantastic, they're fantastic. No, they're fantastic, you know. Couldn't begin to understand, huh? Understand it. That's a hidden hand. That's pretty close to revealed in my book. I mean, you know. Now, the truth is, it happens to us all the time, these kind of things. They happen all the time. At the moment they happen, you don't, you know, you get excited about it and you say, hey, that's amazing, you know, etc. But you say, it's a small world. That's what you usually say. It's a small world. It's not a small world, it's a big world, but Hashem's managing it. Purim is exactly that. Purim is a crisscrossing of events, isn't it? Purim, Rav Dessler always used to say, Purim is a number of themes that crisscross. What are the themes? You've been through the Megillah, I'm not going to go through the details. The details in the themes you can work out for yourself are unrelated events. Unrelated events, the king killed his wife for a certain reason, not connected to the Jews seemingly. Esther gets chosen, no obvious reason. The king can't sleep one night because of his own personal things. It so happens he can't sleep on the same night that Haman comes to try and ask him for permission to kill Mordechai. It so happens that the king asks him to read the Chronicles because he wakes up thinking, yes, the king, you're familiar with the story. He can't sleep. He wakes up with a nightmare. What's the nightmare? Haman's trying to kill him. He just happens to dream on that night that Haman's trying to kill him. Why? Maybe he's jealous of Esther. And Esther fed on that, by the way, later. And Hashem helped that. Haman fell on the bed where she was lying. You remember what happened? To drive the king crazy. That was what finished it. But when the king woke up with this nightmare of Haman trying to kill him, who happens to be in the courtyard? Haman happens to be there. What's he there for? To ask for permission to kill Mordechai. Just so happens. And the king says, if somebody's trying to kill me, why does no one ever tell me anything? Maybe people don't tell me things because maybe somebody once told me something I never rewarded him. So he calls for the chronicles, the annals, the archives of his state to see maybe, and they happen to open the book where? Exactly at the place where Mordechai once saved his life and he never rewarded him. That's how it happens. By the way, it says that the book fell open to that place and the person reading was Haman's son. The Medrash says that Haman's son was a servant of the king, and as soon as he saw the event, he quickly turned over. And the king said, what did you do? Go back, go back. So he was forced to read Yes, he himself, you understand the ironies here, he himself was forced to read about how Mordechai had saved someone. So the king said to Haman, how would you honor somebody? So Haman thinks, me. So he means Mordechai. I mean, the whole, and then all the events start crisscrossing, right? But there's no miracle. Hashem's name is not mentioned. There's no event over there that nobody fell up. The sea never split, right? God didn't appear. Events, political machinations and things. But the Jewish people's greatness was they saw it. You see, in certain sources it says that the difference between Purim and Pesach, those are the two ends of a spectrum. Pesach is redemption also, but that's redemption in the light. Pesach is redemption when Hashem appears. In Pesach you don't have to believe, you see it. Pesach was going out of Egypt, yeah? Yetzias Mitzrayim. Hashem appears in Egypt and takes everyone out. There's no, you don't have any choice whether you're going to. You have to blind not to see. Open miracles are happening all the time. And the Jewish people get no credit for that. The Jewish people get no credit for Pesach. Hashem appears and gives them Torah. In fact, it says when he gave us the Torah a few weeks later, Shavuos, we had no free choice. His presence was so blindingly clear that people had no free choice. Of course you had to accept the Torah. You know what really considered binding acceptance of the Torah at Purim? Because at Purim, when Hashem appeared in a way that wasn't appearing, all it was political events, yes, and coincidences. And there the Jewish people chose to see Hashem. That's called acceptance of the Torah. That's what the Gemara says, that's what binds us. Pesach acceptance of the Torah is not binding. But Purim's acceptance of the Torah is binding. These two themes of acceptance, of miracle, of redemption in the light, and redemption in the darkness, if you trace them, actually you see fantastic, so much to talk about. If you trace them back, you see that even they have the most incredible intertwined hidden beginning. You know that the Gemara talks about this. Gemara talks about this in in Nazir. Commentaries talk about it. You know that if you trace these themes back, where do Purim and Pesach, you know, everything starts from a common seed. We've said that often. Go back early enough in Genesis, in Bereshit, you trace any two things back to a common seed. Where's the common seed, the common nucleus of Purim and Pesach? Well, the commentaries say, in Lot. Lot. Yeah, without going into too much detail. You remember that Lot was living in Sodom, in Stone. Right? By the way, the word Lot contains the two ideas. You know that the word Lat, in Aramaic, means a curse. But if you reverse the letters, it spells Tal, which means the blessing of resurrection. Tal Shel Tzchiah, the dew of resurrection. The same name. Now, the same numerical value, the same letters, depending on how you look at it, is either the curse dimension or it's the redemption dimension. In this man who represented both curse dimension, he ended up having a sexual relationship with his daughters, right? Which inside actually was a mitzvah. The Gemara says that it was an Aveira Lishma, which is greater, that means it was sin for the right reason, which is greater than a mitzvah for the wrong reason. That's what the Gemara says. But while he was, how did that happen? He was in Sdom, you remember? And he hosted two guests, two visitors who happened to be angels, right? And an interesting story, he was prepared to give his life for it. I mean, the paradox of what happened, he's prepared to give his life, why? Because he represents what he learned in Abraham's house, which is hospitality. And he insists that these two strangers come into his home. At the risk of his life, they already killed his daughter, you know that. The Medrash says they killed his daughter, the people of Sdom. Sdom, if you hosted a visitor, and he was too short for the bed, they stretched him apart, they pulled him apart. If it was too long, they cut his legs off. At a stone, you weren't allowed to give anything to anyone. And she once gave a crust of bread to a poor man, so the people of Stone put her on the roof, they tied her down, smeared her with honey, and let the beast sting her to death. That's what they did to his daughter. He was a very great man, he was very committed to his values, and he hosted these two strangers anyway. Only when the people got very, very pressing, and they threatened to break down the door, so he went out and offered them his daughters. That's what it says, quite openly. He went out and said, take my... that's what you want, so you'll end up having a relationship with him. That's what happened. I mean, all these strange things. So here's this paradoxical, problematic man. He's sitting in Stone on the eve of the destruction. The next morning is going to be sulfur, fire raining down from Shemana. Such a holocaust that the girls who survived thought there was no one left on earth. That's why they made their father drunk and had a relationship with him. They thought there were no human beings. So on the eve of that immense holocaust, what do you have? You have Lot sitting in his house, miraculously protected from the outside because the people outside became blind, the door became sealed. He's sitting at the table with the townspeople milling around trying to kill him. The next morning, everybody's going to be wiped out. And he's sitting at the table with his two guests. And what are they eating? What are they eating? What are they doing? They're eating matzah. Matzah? Why? Happened to be Pesach. Of course, Pesach hadn't happened yet. There was no Jewish people yet. But the spiritual energies of Pesach were swirling around in the world at that time. And people spiritually sensitive like Abraham also fed the angels who'd been with him just before. He fed them matzah too. So think about it. They're sitting at the table at this night, and what are they eating? Pesach Seder. This is the Pesach Seder. This is the first Pesach Seder in the world. Here's Lot, sitting with his two angels, eating matzah. It's a Pesach Seder. But you know what's amazing about it? What's mind-boggling about it? The Chumash uses a very unusual word for that meal. It does not say it was a suda, a seuda, which is a meal. The Chumash there uses a very unusual word. It calls it a mishteh. Mishteh means a feast. And you know where the word mishteh crops up again? Purim suda. The Purim suda is called mishteh. So what do you have? You have that Lot was sitting with these two angels, and one in the same time they were eating Pesach Seder and a Purim Suda. What does that mean? The two, and in whose body? In Lot's body is a seed. The next night, he'll be in a cave after the world is wiped out. His older daughter will have a relationship with him. She'll become pregnant. Who will be born from that seed? A nation called Moab. Who will come out of Moab? Ruth. Who will be the great-grandson of Ruth? David HaMelech, the Mashiach. The Mashiach, by the way, even the second daughter, Ammon, out of her came Naamah, who married Shlomo. So it was also the seed of Mashiach, from both sides. So here's this forerunner, this man, hidden within him that he doesn't even know. Is the seed of Mashiach, of redemption. And the seed of redemption is that which will raise its head in history later as open revelation, Pesach time, and hidden revelation, Purim time. And both of those seeds are hidden within him, and unknown to himself even. He's very celebrating it. Making there, yeah, unknown, a Pesach Seder, Purim Suda all in one, and this seed is about to be given birth. That's where it comes from. If we look just a drop deeper, let's try and take this one step deeper. We're trying to work our way back to Haman Minah Torah Minayim. What is Hamina Eitz? Did you eat from the tree? What is this? So we have the following idea. This you'll find in the Tzadok HaKohen. He speaks out this idea. It's a really fantastic idea. Try and put it together now. It says this. Try and put together this whole idea of hidden things, hidden miracles, coincidences. Really showing you something deeper. The Balaam Musa always said that if you want to understand your life, looking at your life in isolation, any point in time, you'll never understand anything. You must write a Megillah of your life. You want to know who you are? You want to know where you're going? Write a Megillah. Write a Megaleh. A Gilui. If you say, who am I now? What am I? Who knows? But write a Megillah. What happened to you that got you to this point? Who did you meet and what happened? And you'll see sometimes it's so bizarre that you ended up here. So unpredictable. Yes, for some of us. Would you have said a year ago that you were going to be doing what you're doing now here? And what was needed to get you into that? It's remarkable. Do you see a directing hand that steers everything when you put it together in that way? Let's look at that from a Torah point of view. So, you know that if you trace this theme, right? Going back to seeds and you trace it. Where did Haman come from? Let's trace him back. You're well aware, I don't have to remind you of the details. He was descended from Agag, right? Who was a king of Amalek in his generation, whom Saul, King Saul, Solomon, was supposed to wipe out. Where did Agag come from? Back from Amalek, the original nation, who were what? They were the people whose task in life is to wipe out the Jewish people, right? Amalek is that people who, now let's understand, physically it means that they dedicated to killing Jews, which ideology has persisted throughout history. There are many connections in Germany, by the way. 50 years ago, and Amalek, many, in ideology and many themes that come out. That is a suicidal desire to wipe out Jews. But we want to look spiritually. And we know that if ever we see something physical, we know that if you look beneath it, you'll find the same thing spiritually. If there are two people on earth who are in a life and death battle, the Jewish people who have to destroy Amalek when we can, and they who are hell-bent, yes, on destroying us. Spiritually, it means that our spiritual energies are locked in lethal battle. That means what we represent in the world, they have to kill. And we have to, yes, what do we represent? We represent bringing Hashem into the world. What is a Jew? What is a Jew? Bringing Hashem into the world. What is Torah? Torah, bringing Torah into the world is to manifest Hashem's presence. You know, Oraisa, the word Torah means light. Means shining light into the darkness. That's what Torah is. How do we have to bring Torah into the world? In such a way that even if others can't see it, we have to show it. You know, Hashem says, Atem Eda, you are my witnesses. We are my witnesses. The Jays witnesses, by the way. You know where they got that from. Where they get this idea from being witnesses? It's a Jewish idea. We are Hashem's witnesses. What is a witness? You only need a witness when the event is not seen. No one ever needs a witness here. The court doesn't need a witness when they sing. Witnesses are always there who saw the event and now say it over when I can't see it. That's what a witness is. So the Jewish people, explicitly their function in the world, is to be witnesses to that which you cannot see now. Hashem's presence in the world that nobody can see. All the nations of the world turn around and say, where is it? We, the witnesses, we testify that we saw it once. That's our job. We bring that evidence into the world. And Amalek, they are there to say Hashem is not here. It's all coincidence. They are there to cause doubt on anything spiritual. Right? The mystics say that the function of Amalek is the gap between Hashem's presence in the world and Hashem being pushed out. They're the gap. They are the chasm. They're the gap. They push him away. They make it unlikely. Do you know that the word Amalek, if you add up its numerical value, equals Sophek, doubt. the numerical value of Amalek is Sofek a doubt. They bring doubt into the world. Actually, there's some commentaries who say that the word Amalek, if you read it carefully, it spells Amal Kof, the work of the monkey, which means that it's that which looks human. Yes, what is a monkey? It's what looks human, but actually doesn't have the human content. Isn't that what Amalek say? Yeah, we look human, but actually we're animal. I mean, isn't that this generation? Yeah, you're a first cousin of a gorilla. See, you look human, you've got all these emotions of nobility and truth and justice. Just instinct, that's all. That's what they say, no? What could be more Amalek consciousness than this generation? That's what it is. So Amalek is there to push Hashem, and that's why the original battle with Amalek was when we moved to receive the Torah, Amalek threw themselves at the Jewish people in a suicidal bid, right, to stop us. Actually, there was hopeless to stop us, because Hashem was taking us to Sinai, miraculously. But they did it anyway. Why? Because Amalek's nature is even suicidally to attack the Jews. Why? Because you'll make some imprint. And you know what happens? The Midrash says, the Gemara says, that when we were moving towards Sinai, the nations realized there was something happening in the world, because the whole world was going through cataclysmic changes, and they went to their prophet Bilam, and they said, what's going on? So Bilam said, Hashem oiz l'amo yitain, Hashem's giving Torah to his people. So the nations said, let's go, and they started streaming towards Sinai. The nations of the earth started streaming towards Sinai to receive Torah, and Amalek said, if they get there, we finished. If they get there, and everyone accepts Torah and Hashem, what's in it for us? Yeah, our job is to stop that. So they threw themselves at the Jewish people, and what happened was, of course, they didn't win, but they did enough damage to show that the Jews are human, and the rest of the nations turned back. And in fact, the pasuk says, "Asher korcha baderech," which means that they met you on the road. They attacked you, but the word korcha means, amazing, it has three meanings. It means cold, kar means cold, keri means sexual impurity, and mikre means coincidence. Huh? That means they happened on you in the way. Not that they attacked you. They like happened to be there. Because all of Amalek is the doubtful dimension of whether things have meaning or don't. So everything they do is coincidence, right? Not meaning, coincidence. Sexual impurity, isn't that what it is? Instead of being loyally bonded to what you have to do to your tachlis, to the woman you should be married to, sexual impurity, right? Just not to be bonded doesn't mean anything. It's only animal anyway. And cold, cooled us down. Rashi says that they were like a man throwing himself into a bath of boiling water. He got badly burnt, but he cooled the water. And they cooled the earth down, they cooled the world down. And they stepped everybody else back from the truth. That's what that was, Amalek. So they all leak, and they're serious about it. Our enemies are serious about it. They really mean it. They're not playing games. Halavai, sometimes we should have some of the death of Emunah that our enemies do. Amalek are serious. They will put themselves suicidally. They're not chicken. Huh? Other nations also, our enemies. People who set as enemies against us are serious. You know, the nations who surround us here. They're not playing games. They're serious about it. They give their lives for sure when it comes to the push. You're aware of that. Not that they're the death of the minute, but they're committed. Their lives don't mean anything. That was Amalek. Who descended from Amalek? Agag. And Saul was supposed to kill him, and he left him alive. And Shmuel killed him the next day. But that night, yes, at the battle of against Amalek. That night, one of his wives had been brought to him. Somebody asked me recently. It was one of his own wives, not a Jewish woman. Had been brought to him, and she conceived. And so the seed of Amalek was left in the world, although he was killed the next day. And who was born from that seed a few generations later? Haman. Actually, it says in Gemara that a Tana who learned Torah in Bnei Brak was also descended from him. Must have converted in as well. How could a Torah sage be descended from the same person that Haman was descended from? See if we can try and understand. But that's what happened. What does all this mean? Let's try and put it all together. The Tzaddik says that, let's trace it back to the beginning. That tree of knowledge of good and evil. Why did Adam eat from that tree? Why did he make that mistake? What was his error in judgment when he ate from that fruit? So a very, very wonderful and deep idea is that the reason he ate that fruit was because his problem was that he found himself in a garden with almost no free choice. Yes, he had almost no free choice. Everything in the world was plain. He saw Hashem clearly. He was like, I once had a Rebbe who said, he was like a man in a rocket ship going 1,000,000 miles an hour. He could work the controls to go 1,000,001, that's all. Just one command, that wasn't enough for him. He wanted to crash himself back into the physical world and do it himself. The motivation was very frum, very, very spiritual. Hashem, I'm not showing my love for you now, because all I'm doing is obeying one tiny command. Right? I want to crash myself down into the creation and build myself up for myself. That, I know you told me not to do it. That all you mean is don't risk it. You don't mean don't do it, you mean it's too dangerous, you don't expect it of me. Huh? And he was right in many ways, you know that? For example, it says, on the day you eat of the fruit of the tree, you'll die. So the snake said to them, "You aren't really dying." It does. And who is right? He didn't die the day they ate the fruit. They were learning the Torah of the situation to mean, Hashem said don't eat it, but what he really means is he doesn't ask it of us. But we want to show our love of Hashem. We want to crash ourselves down into the physical world and become animalistic. And then pull ourselves up on our own. That's proving love. Of course, there's a hidden vested interest in it, right? And that is, the hidden vested interest is me, ego, right? I want to do it. Never mind accepting it as a gift from you with my doing only that amount of work, right? You find yourself as an independent being, newly created, divine image. Don't tell me. I want to do it myself. But it had a very firm... So why did he eat from the tree? To increase free choice. To increase free choice, you have to make a gap between yourself and Hashem. You have to make a gap in the world. While Hashem is speaking to you at first hand, in your presence, you can't do anything wrong. So in order to have free choice and work and serve yourself, you have to push him away. Increase darkness so you can then shine the light into it. So you can then close the gap yourself through your own effort. See, and what happened when he ate the fruit? Boy, did he open a gap. He didn't realize how bad it would be. He opened such a gap in the world that Hashem... How much of a gap? How much of a gap? What happened after he ate the fruit? What did he do right after eating the fruit? He hid in shame. Hiding in shame. Do you know what a pathetic, unbelievably pathetic situation that is? Who's he hiding from? From Hashem. How can you hide from God? He wasn't psychotic. He'd spoken to God minutes before. He knew exactly who Hashem was. He knew that Hashem is infinite and sees everything. How can you hide? Do you understand the paradox, the irony, the pathetic torment of the conflict of that situation? He knows that Hashem sees everything, but he fools himself he can hide. Isn't that us? Huh? He knows what's right, but he fools himself. Hashem can't really see me. Can you imagine the pathos of it? He's crouching under a bush, ashamed of his nakedness, that God shouldn't see him. God, who is everywhere and is everything, who sees everything, penetrates all the physical reality and sees it. He's busy hiding, knowing that he can't hide, he's hiding. What a pathetic situation. And you know what's even worse, even more pathetic? Is Hashem's response. Hashem enters the garden and says to him, "Where are you? You play the game, I play the same game with you. You want to pretend that you can hide from me. You force me to relate to you the same way. Where are you?" You know what that means? Can you imagine his pain when he heard those words? All he wanted was to be pulled up like a naughty child and corrected and be brought back into his father's love. But when you do that, Hashem doesn't... You understand? He's crouching under the bushes, desperate with shame, unable to face Hashem, fooling himself. And Hashem arrives and says, "Where are you? I can't see you." Building his own illusion, tormenting... And then Hashem says, and that word Ayeka, "Where are you?" is Eicha. That's the beginning of lamentation. And then Hashem says to him, Did you eat from? I don't know. I don't see you anymore. I don't see you. You've built your own reality. You have such a gap from me, I can't even penetrate it. Did you eat? Hamin ha'et. Haman. Did you eat? The question itself, not the word for evil. The question means, if I, Hashem, have to ask you a question, it means I don't know. My not knowing, you understand? My not knowing, my gap from you, my lack of perception, my gap from the world, that's all phrased in the question, isn't it? Imagine when Adam heard those words. Hamin, did you? He's asking me, did I? Hashem is asking me if I did. Hashem is telling me that he doesn't see me. Right? That's Haman, isn't it? That's exactly what Haman is. Now that some of them, before she say that when... Saul, when King Saul left Amalek, left Agag alive, why did he do it? Why didn't he kill him? He killed the whole nation. He had mercy, he couldn't bring it. So why did he leave Agag? So one of the deep ideas is, the reason he left Agag alive was because he made the same mistake as Adam did. By the way, the Gnostic commentaries say that they all made the same mistake. All the great figures of Jewish history made the same mistake. Noach, when he drank and got drunk. King Solomon, when he tackled evil, took evil on at face-to-face battle. But what Shaul HaMelech decided to do was, if I kill Agag and I finish off Amalek, what happens when you finish off Amalek? The Mashiach is here. If he would have killed every last member of Amalek in that battle to the dead, there would have been no Amalek. If there's no Amalek in the world, it means there's no gap in the spiritual world. If there's no gap, it means Hashem is here now. Some of the sources say that if Saul had killed Agag, he would have, the next day he would have handed over the reins of leadership to David, who would have been the Mashiach. And Saul would have been the Mashiach ben Yosef, he was from Binyamin. He would have represented the Mashiach ben Yosef and handed over to the Mashiach ben David, and that would have been a mess. So Saul said to himself, "We're not ready for that. If we do that, it means we enter a state where there's no free choice." And he wanted to leave just a little bit of work in the world, just a little bit of a gap, just one man from Amalek, just a bit of a gap so we can work through the gap. Same mistake. Same mistake that had started the problems, and it didn't work. Same mistake. Shmuel killed him, but it's too late. So in summary, what do we see? When the Gemara says, Haman min HaTorah min Ma'in, where do we see the name Haman? We find it back in that tree. And that's what Amalek represents. They represent the gap, Sophek, doubt. You're a man, you're a monkey, it's in doubt. Don't know, today you feel like a man, tomorrow you feel like a monkey. When it chooses you this, suits you, you choose this, suits you, you choose that. Right? You live in a world where the whole ideology is Amalek. The whole world is there. The whole world is lethally anti-Jewish. Make no mistake about it. The whole world, yes, is desperate to kill Jews, and at the same time saying that there's no such thing as ideology. Nobody means anything anyway. All monkeys are there. A complete confusion, right? Of coincidence, doubt, and a complete challenge of ideas, right? Is Western culture. And that, through that maze, you have to find your way and pick out meaning. And that picking out meaning through the maze of history and of politics and of events, that is the work that a Jew has to do. That's teach himself at Purim time, teach himself how to do for the rest of his